London does royal weddings. They do very good royal weddings. It's something London seems to revel in. And there have been some amazing royal weddings of late. But the large crowds, the cheers, the riot of colour and flags, these are not new things. London's been doing this for quite a while. And in the latter parts of the 1230s, there was an especially joyful royal wedding where the city revelled that their king had finally took a bride, even if there was something seriously wrong about the wedding. And something seriously wrong about the king, and by extension, something pretty darn wrong about the nation around it. Hi there, my name is Saul, and this is the Story of London, a podcast dedicated to telling the history of the city in regular weekly episodes, presenting the tale of the place in a grand narrative, trying to explain the sheer scale and scope of the city's history and how it related to the country and the world around it and how they related to it. This week we are deep in the reign of King Henry III, and trust me, this guy was the longest ruling of the medieval monarchs, so we're going to be with him for a while yet, and we are covering 6 years during which the city had to deal with pushy foreign bankers, cope with a salacious royal scandal, but not the scandal we think it is, adjust to a major drought, and much, much more. Welcome then to Chapter 89 of The Story of London, Celebrations Most Royal. We're going to begin with a few moments of national politics, a brief glimpse of the wider events in England that were taking place and were about to have an impact on London as we go along. England was ruled by Henry III, but he was seemingly content for the Bishop of Winchester, William Des Rochers, to run the government for him. Des Rochers, however, felt politically insecure in his position, so he sought to get rid of his opponents from the royal court and build for himself and his followers a support base based on lucrative royal offices, castles and lands. According to Roger of Wendover, under Des Rochers' advice, King Henry III began to, quote, exile his nobles and barons without judgment of their peers, burning their villages and houses, cutting down their woods and orchards and destroying their parks and fish ponds, unquote. Sounds like typical medieval king behaviour, really, but the issue here, well, this was supposed to be a land running under the auspices of the Magna Carta. You didn't do this stuff without the judgment of their peers. The kind of things that were going on sounded like the king was wiping his ass with the Magna Carta, to be honest. This inevitably caused tensions between the king and several leading nobles, including Richard Marshall, the son of William Marshall, the man who had helped make Henry king in the first place. This in turn led to two rebellions in 1233, which, while minor, caused the king difficulties in suppressing a much bigger rebellion going on in Wales. The situation in England became increasingly untenable, with nobles actually discussing deposing Henry as early as June 1233, during a significant council of state at Westminster in February. English bishops urged the king to distance himself from Bishop Des Rochers and his harmful associates, and to assert his authority. Well, Henry agreed in principle, he did fear the repercussions of intervening in the realm's actual politics. And in the midst of all this political tension, the king left Westminster and decided to go to visit some holy sites over in East Anglia. Think about it. There is a genuine political crisis going on. The nobles of England are feeling attacked by a capricious first minister of the kingdom. There are rebellions, and the powers that be are actually talking about hauling the king up over the issues that had almost caused his father to face a country-wrecking civil war. And Henry decides now is the time to go on a wee pilgrimage. By April 1234, Richard Marshall had died from injuries gained in battle in Ireland, which led people to accuse the king of secretly murdering him. And a month later, the crisis became so acute that the English clergy under Archbishop Edmund Rich threatened the crown with excommunication. Eventually, finally, Henry III realized he would have to, like, you know, rule the country. He removed Des Rochers and acknowledged that the bishop had failed to uphold the principles of the Magna Carta. Nobles should not be judged against without the consent of their peers, at least. And so, by 1234, after over a decade on the throne, Henry III was now king and power in his own right. This year was also where that pilgrimage he took signified something else. He withdrew into his faith. The political crisis of the last few years, well, nowhere near as serious as the ones his father had ever faced, had hurt this emotionally vulnerable young man. He began to devote himself, increasingly, to professions of faith, especially in regards to Edward the Confessor. Henry III, as we described a few chapters ago, had made Edward his patron saint in many respects, but increasingly, he began to see himself as being the spiritual son of that long-dead Anglo-Saxon king. Like him, he was a pious ruler surrounded by grasping and clammy lesser souls. Henry III was not suited to be king. He was fundamentally a nervous chap, weak-willed, and suffered from a clear inferiority complex, especially in regards to the French, but we'll come back to that several times. However, over the last few years, while this was going on, London had problems of its own, and this problem was financial. As I've been saying over the last few chapters, the state of England's finances during the reign of Henry III were pretty dire. The Civil War, the First Barons' War, had wrecked the economy, and worse than that, foreign merchants had begun to hone in and exploit these weaknesses. I will, in a future chapter, focus specifically on this issue, but one manifestation of this was the rise in London of a new class of merchants who were causing, according to the contemporary historian Matthew Paris, a huge amount of upset. And this is why we're going to talk about the Corsines. This seems to have been the name Matthew Paris gave at the time to a bunch of French merchantmen, known better as Cahorsines. And they were about to become a big deal in the story of London, at least economically, over the next few years. So who were they? The Cahorsines were the residents of the region around the town in the south of France, known as Cahors, merchants and traders, who branched out of importing and exporting goods and began to delve into the lucrative trade of money lending. What made them particularly despised, however, is that while they were Christian, the Cahorsines had decided to charge interest on their loans. Now remember, this was technically the sin of usury, and this kind of thing people felt was only done by Jews and was the usual insult to insult Jews about. But here were a bunch of Christians doing this openly. And they were not just charging interest, they were charging what sounds like compound interest on loans and, well, conniving to make it look not like interest. The Cahorsines sound like one of those payday lenders that used to be so prevalent in Britain. Unregulated money lenders who would offer easy money but would ensnare their borrowers with high interest rates and vicious terms and conditions. And I'm serious about those terms and conditions. Consider what Matthew Paris said about them at the time. Quote, "In these days prevailed the horrible nuisance of the Cahorsines, to such a degree that there was hardly anyone in all England, especially among the bishops, who was not caught in their net. Even the king himself was held indebted to them in an incalculable sum of money, for they circumvented the needy in their necessities, cloaking their usury under the show of trade, and pretending to not know that whatever is added to the principal is usury, under whatever name it may be called," unquote. And then, like some early medieval investigative journalist, Matthew Paris decides to describe one of their contracts to prove his point, exposing the methods by which these Kursines, or Karasins, gained so much power and profit. What I find fascinating is that in between the descriptions of a 13th century loans, terms and conditions, is the way that London, the money pit, is mentioned so often. Regardless of where people were when they received the loan, the unspoken implication here was that London was still the principal financial centre of the realm. The money pit was functioning as the fulcrum for all matters financial in England, and the Knights Templar were the ones overseeing and facilitating all large transactions in the country. So according to the rather irate account by Matthew Paris, the example of the Kursines contract would begin with a person receiving the money signing a document that started with the words, quote, "Be it known to you that we have received on loan at London for the purpose of usefully settling matters concerning us and our church," unquote. And then Paris creates a sum of money either based on some random figure or more likely, Matthew Paris was copying an actual Kursine contract where he describes a loan for, quote, 104 marks of good and lawful money sterling, each mark being computed at 13 shillings and 4 pence sterling, unquote. To gain the loan, the contract said the debtor had to, quote, on the feast of St. Peter ad Vinicula, namely the first day of the month of August, at the New Temple, London, promise by lawful covenant and bind ourselves in our own name and in that of our church that we will pay and discharge in full, adding moreover this condition, that if the aforesaid money shall not be paid and discharged at the place and term aforesaid, as has been said, we promise from that time, by the same covenant, to give and render to the aforesaid merchants, or their certain emissary, every 2 months, for every 10 marks, 1 mark of said money, in recompense for losses, which losses and expenses these merchants might incur or receive therefrom, unquote. So, technically, it's not interest, it's penalty fees. These penalty fees, by the way, quote, in no wise shall be reckoned towards the principal of said debt, unquote, aka they were treating them as penalty fees, possibly their way of allowing claims was not an interest on the loan. And it didn't contribute towards the loan at all. And furthermore, the person receiving the money, the person who received the loan, agreed that, quote, we bind ourselves and our church and our successors and all our goods and those of our church, movable and immovable, ecclesiastical and temporal, in possession or hereafter to be in possession, wherever they shall be found, to the said merchants and their heirs, until the full payment of the aforesaid, unquote. So, here was a loan, which your entire worldly goods became collateral for. And unless you had the funds to pay it all back, then transactions overseen in the headquarters of the Knights Templar in London, you had to pay penalty fees upon it if you didn't pay it off. And these were inflicted every 8 weeks. And while today we would say, well, this seems like, you know, a harsh but not totally alien standard loan condition, remember, this is the 13th century. So this is all new and radical and incredibly upsetting. The small print also said that to get the loan, you actually had to agree to, quote, consent on all the aforesaid to be convened in all places and before any tribunal and to renounce, for ourselves and our successors, all aid of the law, both canon and civil, the privilege both of clerkship and of court, the letter of St. Adrian, every custom and statute, all letters, indulgences and privileges obtained, or to be hereafter obtained, from the apostolic see of the King of England and all the people of his kingdoms, and all other exceptions, real and personal, which might be objected against this instrument or deed, unquote. So you've already signed away, in all perpetuity, any kind of legal recompense against the contract of this loan. Like, screw you, buddy. Matthew Paris goes on to describe the conditions caused by these loans as such. Quote, Such were the inextricable bonds by which the Corsines bound their debtors. They were truly named Corsines, if I may play upon the word, from Casor, to cheat, and Ursine, bearish. They first enticed the needy with soft and honeyed words, but in the end pierced them as though with a spear, unquote. This raw indignation described by Paris was not an isolated view. The whole of London objected to these French merchants becoming moneylenders like this, and the objection of London was led by their bishop. Now, the Bishop of London at this time was a man called Roger Niger, also known as St. Roger of Beeley, and he'd come up in London church authorities by the usual routes. He'd first turned up as a prebendary official, and he'd been elected as Bishop of London in 1229. According to the account of this, quote, "In the same year, Roger, Bishop of London, a learned and devout man, perceiving that the Corsines openly multiplied their usury without shame and led a most filthy life, harassing religious men with various injuries and amassing heaps of riches from the numbers who were forced to submit to their yoke, was roused to violent indignation and kindled with zeal for the cause of justice. Wherefore, he admonished them as schismatics to desist from such enormities, as they valued the salvation of their souls, and to do penance for their misdeeds," unquote. Strong words. However, the bishop's condemnation was met with derision from these French merchants. Quote, "This warning they set at naught with laughter and ridicule and even threats," unquote. And this actually gives us an insight into the power of these moneylenders. They responded to the condemnation of the Bishop of London with threats back at him. These guys were pretty sure of themselves. And the Bishop of London, well, they're a Bishop of London. They were not having that. Quote, "Whereupon the bishop, arming himself with the weapons of spiritual justice, launched a general anathema against all of them, and briefly and decidedly ordered them to depart at once out of the city of London, which had then been free from such a pest that his diocese might not be tainted with such a stain," unquote. This was it. It was a throwdown. Led by the bishop, London had decided that enough was enough. These bloody French moneylenders could piss off out of our city. The Corsines, however, were not in the slightest bit worried. Because, you see, they were, as you may have picked up from their nationality, international bankers and moneylenders, you see. They'd financed the Catharian Crusade. They had loaned money to many in Rome. And as such, quote, "swelling with pride and trusting in the Pope's protection, without difficulty or loss of time, obtained at the court of Rome that said bishop, who is now old, weak, and ill, should be cited peremptorily to distant parts beyond the sea, before judges who were friends of the Corsines and chosen at their option, so that he should appear and answer for the wrong done to the Pope's merchants," unquote. Bishop Roger of London and the city soon discovered that these French moneylenders had friends in very high places. Exceptionally high places, and he was facing being summoned abroad to answer for his kicking them out of the city. At this, the bishop chickened out and, quote, "choosing like Shem to cover his father's nakedness rather than with Ham to expose it, put a peaceful end to the tumult that had been raised," unquote. So here we are, around the year 1235, and what do we see? A bunch of rich, foreign-based moneylenders and financiers are squeezing the authorities of London to allow their somewhat dubious practices just carry on. And when a local civic leader raises a voice of objection, they use their wealth and connections to get him to back the hell down. So, you know, tell me, what's changed? While this was about events 789 years ago, it could have been a story that appeared in local headlines over the last 10 years. Tell me I'm lying. Now, these Corsines, the Corazins of southern France, they do not disappear from our story, far from it. These guys are now part of the story of London and will remain so for some time. Their impact will only actually increase as times go by. Consider this an introduction to the newest members of London's money pit. Meanwhile, London witnessed some other new exotic arrivals in the city, apparently. In 1235, the Holy Roman Emperor, seeking to butter up King Henry in the hopes of England maybe joining forces with them against the French, supposedly sent the king a gift, three leopards, the symbol of Henry's illustrious uncle, Richard I. The leopards were an incredible gift, but begged the question, where the hell do you keep them? The tradition says that it was in 1235 that these three animals were kept in a compound within the Tower of London, and that this date denotes the start of the Tower Menagerie, the collection of exotic animals that the kings and queens of England were to send to be kept in the compound of the Tower. I'm not too sure if it is accurate, but it's a good enough date to start dating the whole thing from. However, as 1336 arrived, London now had a brand new pressing issue facing it. It needed to clean itself up, and clean itself up sharpish. And why? Well, King Henry III was getting married. As you can imagine, this was a big thing. By now, Henry was about 5'6" tall. He wasn't particularly imposing. And looks-wise, it was commented that he had a drooping eyelid, which gave him a crooked, sad-looking face, which matched his somewhat ponderous character. He was noticeably pious, even in an age where it was the fashion for kings to be pious. And in fact, he was so pious, he'd get into a game of who is the most devout with young King Louis IX of France, the king who would go on to plan such devotional spaces as the Sainte-Chapelle and would then spend a fortune obtaining the crown of thorns and a fragment of the true cross to bring to France. And Henry would also engage in trying to get high-powered relics to compete, but we'll get to that at a future moment. But while Henry III was not an impressive sight in person, he was somewhat self-consciously given to greater displays of kingly magnificence than any other king of England previous to him. It could actually be argued he became the greatest bestower of patronage of any of England's medieval kings. He commissioned scores of paintings and artworks that celebrated what one historian calls, quote, the virtuous antiquity of kingship, unquote. The windows and walls of royal palaces were adorned with his favourite religious and historical scenes and figures. St. Edward the Confessor was everywhere, but St. Eustace had a painting done, and that was placed to stand guard over the king's bed in Westminster Palace. He also commissioned artwork of the great kingly heroes of the past, Alexander the Great, for example, or paintings of his uncle's supposedly amazing exploits in the Holy Land. Well, he could not do much right. Henry III was, in his own way, a master propagandist, allowing the fineries of royal rule advertise the magnificence of the post, of the tradition he inherited. Records suggest he spent a tenth of all his royal revenue, so about £3,000 a year, on buildings and art and fine things, like a plethora of fine gold cups, glorious crowns, dazzling vestments, beautiful candles, and an endless array of jewels by which Henry surrounded himself constantly. As such, he knew that the whole of England, and by extension the whole of Europe, would be focused upon his marriage. It was to be a big thing, a huge thing, a symbolic moment. And as such, it was going to be something that his reign would depend upon, symbolically as much as personally. In January 1236, having carefully sought permission of the Great Council to marry, the 28-year-old Henry finally took as his queen the 12-year-old Eleanor of Provence. Yeah, 12-year-old. Like his father had kind of with his mother, the king seemed utterly fine with so young a bride. Away from this rather disconcerting factor, the choice of bride actually did seem, from a political point of view, somewhat odd. Henry had been previously engaged to a French heiress called Joan, but the French royal court had blown a gasket at the idea of a King of England marrying into a county on the northern French coast for, you know, obvious reasons, and that marriage alliance had fallen apart. As such, Henry turned to the family of Count Ramon Berengar IV of Provence. Now, here is where we begin to see King Henry of England's desire to keep up with his French rival Louis begin to raise its head. You see, Eleanor's older sister, Margaret, was already married to King Louis IX of France. And anything Louis can do, so can Henry. Young Eleanor of Provence was a southerner, and like Henry's grandmother, Eleanor of Aquitaine before her, she brought with her the interests and influence of a warm, culturally vibrant southern French culture. And yet, that's basically all she brought. And like Eleanor of Aquitaine, Eleanor of Provence had no lands she could give the king. And this was actually commented upon by some as making her totally unsuitable to be queen. But what the girl lacked in huge tracts of land, she made up for with political connections. See, not only was her sister the Queen of France, but her mother's family had some serious links to the Holy Roman Empire and to the papacy. The king's new mother-in-law, Beatrice of Savoy, had a bunch of brothers, all of whom were famous diplomats with alliances and contacts all through Europe. In terms of land, this family, the Savoyards, controlled the northern passage into Italy, and as such, the county was in the thick of all the diplomatic struggles between the Holy Roman Emperor Frederick and the papacy. This is the same Holy Roman Emperor who had given Henry the three leopards, which were now supposedly prowling around the Tower of London. And you know what? Henry did see the empire as a key to his own political and diplomatic ambitions. In fact, he'd proven this a year before when he had allowed his baby sister Isabella marry Emperor Frederick II. This union with the young Eleanor of Provence reinforced his links via a backdoor way via his mother-in-law to the imperial court. So basically, even if the current Plantagenet King of England's lands were now restricted to England and just a part of Gascony, with this marriage, it clearly said that Henry wished to remain involved in wider European power politics. So for these reasons, Henry knew that this was why the eyes of Europe would be upon his wedding ceremony in Canterbury on the 20th of January 1236, and then in particular on the new Queen's coronation, which would take place in Westminster just 6 days later. There was immense pomp and circumstance for this event in London. Eyewitness description of the day sounds incredible. Quote, "There were assembled at the king's nuptial festivities such a host of nobles of both sexes, such numbers of religious men, such crowds of the populace, and such a variety of actors that London, with his capricious bosom, could scarcely contain them. The whole city was ornamented with flags and banners, chaplets and hangings, candles and lamps, and with wonderful devices and extraordinary representations, and all the roads were cleansed from mud and dirt, sticks and everything offensive." Unquote. Yeah, going back to my original point when I said London had to clean up its act, yeah, it's clear from that last sentence, they cleared out all the shit. All the shit. This was a royal wedding. Always a good excuse to clear out the copious amounts of shit from the streets and make the city splendid for the dark-haired, raven-eyed beauty who was the queen. No, she's a 12-year-old girl. Come on. Yeah, can't accept that. Anyway, the celebration saw London utterly beside itself. The city always enjoyed a good royal wedding. And they were not just witnesses, they were part of it. Quote, "The citizens too went out to meet the king and queen, dressed out in their ornaments, and vied with each other in trying the speed of their horses. On the same day, when they left the city for Westminster to perform the duties of butler to the king, which office belonged to them by right of old at the coronation, they proceeded thither dressed in silk garments, with mantles worked in gold, and with costly changes of raiment, mounted on valuable horses, glittering with new bits and saddles, and riding in troops arranged in order. They carried with them 360 gold and silver cups, preceded by the king's trumpeters, and with horns sounding, so that such a wonderful novelty struck all who beheld it with astonishment." Unquote. Yeah, it turns out that there was tradition at royal weddings that the citizens of London basically get to be butlers for the occasion, serving all the nobles and lords of the country with their wine. Now, there are reports that Andrew Buckerell, the new mayor of London, was somehow forbidden from performing his ceremonial duties to the king. But I actually can't find any source for this happening, so mention it as a possibility because I've read it in some books. But from this account, it does not seem to have been so. The ceremony itself and the wedding feast that came afterwards were filled with huge amounts of pageantry and ritual, and as always, London was at the heart of it. Quote, "The Archbishop of Canterbury, by right especially belonging to him, performed the duty of crowning with the usual solemnities, the Bishop of London assisting him as a dean, the other bishops taking their stations according to their rank," unquote. Ancient customs carrying on, old rituals being enacted, based on what supposedly always happened. And at the wedding feast afterwards in the Palace of London, the mayor does seem to have led the citizens of the city in their appointed role. Quote, "The citizens of London passed the wine about in all directions in costly cups, and those of Winchester superintended the cooking of the feast. The rest, according to the ancient statutes, filled their separate stations, or made their claims to do so. And in order that the nuptial festivities might not be clouded by any disputes, saving the right of any, many things were put up with for the time, which they left for decision at a more favourable opportunity. The office of the Chancellor of England, and all the offices connected to the King, were ordained and assized in the Exchequer. Therefore, the Chancellor, the Chamberlain, the Marshal, and the Constable, by right of their office, took their seats there, as also did the barons, according to the date of their creation, in the City of London, whereby they each knew his own place. The ceremony was splendid." Unquote. It sounds like a glorious day of pomp and tradition. Still, we know there were other rituals that also seemed to be carried on. This was a big formal celebration in Westminster Palace, and oh look, there are reports of anti-Jewish violence in London. This time at least the Jewish community got wind of it, and it was reported they took shelter in the newly expanded Tower of London until this particular wave of anti-Semitic hate blew over. The royal wedding of 1236 was a turning point in the reign of Henry II. He was like, you know, a man in his own right. And as he took his young queen off to Glastonbury to study the mythic burial site of King Arthur, weird honeymoon, London got to bask in the afterglow of this glorious ceremony. And the city looked briefly clean. The shit had been lifted. Anyone who remembers chapter 56, the London Epimeris, will remember just how much shit there were. But it also gave the city an excuse to sort out other things, like its water supplies. The burgeoning city's growing population needed fresh water, and the royal wedding seems to have been an excuse the aldermen and the exchequers needed to start addressing the issue. London gained permission to tap the spring of the River Tyburn and take its water into the city. Now, this spring was located outside of London. Today, it's just off Oxford Street, where you'd find Stratford Place. And the purpose of this water was, according to them, quote, "for the profit of the city and good of the whole realm thither repairing, to wit, for the poor to drink and the rich to dress their meat," unquote. And while this royal wedding may have been the cause for this project, there's another reason for London suddenly being concerned about the water supply of the city. As a source at the time says, quote, "in the summer of this year, after a winter beyond measure rainy, a constant drought attended by an almost unendurable heat, which lasted for 4 months or more. The marshes and lakes were dried up to their very bottoms. Watermills stood uselessly still, the water being dried up, and the earth gaped with numerous fissures. The corn, too, in a great many places, scarcely grew to the height of 2 feet, unquote. So yeah, for whatever reason, London needed water. And yet supplying water from the Tyburn was actually quite a large undertaking of civic engineering. This is the 13th century after all. In order for it to work, lead pipes had to take the water from the spring across the countryside following the River Tyburn to suddenly reach a field where today stands Piccadilly, then cut across this field to where today stands Charing Cross, and then follow Fleet Street across the River Fleet through the wall near Ludgate, then go to the north of St. Paul's and end up in Cheapside. And the biggest issue these engineers faced, the Fleet River Valley, which was quite the depression to overcome and which we believe taxed the skills of the builders quite a lot. Crossing the Fleet was always tough, and in fact we see the first need for maintenance repairs being mentioned on that particular section as soon as 1350. And so we understand, this was only the start of London coming to terms with its need for fresh water and the issues caused by bad sanitation. Within 10 years, a much larger water project would begin. And in 1037, during the section we're studying, the city was also repairing the public privy down by the river in Queenhithe, one which had been erected during the reign of Henry I. It was getting a bit worse for wear and there were repairs need to be done this year. Look at those Eschivins go, being all up and looking after the locals. But, you know, just so we can all know, the only reason they did this at this stage was because things had to be really bad for them to commit any money to anything. You can imagine how grim that public privy had become. Meanwhile, across in the rest of the country, there was a lot going on, including in 1236, a meeting between the king and the barons, and it shows you just how tense relationships were. Because there were some issues, and it says, quote, "On the first day of the council, the king went to the Tower of London and gave great cause of discontent to many about this matter, and more unfavourable than prosperous conjectures were entertained. The nobles would not enter singly or in numbers go to the Tower to the king, fearing lest he, yielding to evil counsel, would vent his rage on them," unquote. And while the king relocated to the Palace of Westminster and solved this issue, you can clearly see that there was tensions between the crown and the nobility going on all through this period. As well as all of that, there was a heck of a little war taking place up in Scotland with the Norse Gael diaspora. Yes, the Vikings were still a thing on the Irish Sea, and a huge force of them gathered from the Scottish Isles, the Isle of Man, Galloway and parts of Ireland to try to place the former ruler of Galloway's son on the throne of the microstate after the Scottish King Alexander had divided it between the former king's daughters. It was a messy little bushfire war, and I only mention it because of my previous mentions of the Vikings of the Irish Sea. Here we are, 1236. And records indicate that the descendants of the Vikings were, well, they were able to code switch successfully between the many separate cultures around them. They could visit the courts of the English or the French and there take part in tournaments and grand pageants along with the rest of the baronage and even go on crusade. And yet they could also engage in primitive and pagan rituals of soothsaying and blood magic back at home, as their ancestors supposedly had partaken in. And their fleets of longships allowed them to deploy armies in their thousands. So yeah, the Vikings are still a thing on the Irish Sea. Not for long, but they're still there, even now, in the 13th century. But the most important news for London at this time was an incredible bit of salacious gossip from the royal family, and all to do with the king's sister, Eleanor of Angouleme. Yes, they're all called Eleanor, but just bear with me now. Now, she was the youngest member of the family, this princess, the youngest child of King John and Queen Isabella, and she'd married William Marshall the Younger, who was the eldest son of William Marshall Sr., the regent of the king who had put him on the throne. But William Jr. had died when Princess Eleanor was just 16. She had, even as a 16-year-old, swore an oath of holy chastity and that she would become a nun in mourning as a widow. In January 1238, it was clear that someone had caught her eye, because the rumour was she was pregnant and she just got married. And the man she married, oh boy, it's time to talk about one of the most interesting people in English history at this time, Simon de Montfort. Now, to remind folks, we've mentioned Simon de Montfort, the Earl of Leicester, before, but not this Simon de Montfort, the Earl of Leicester, but his father, the previous title holder. That Simon de Montfort had been busy being this almost full-time crusader knight, pissing about in the Fourth Crusade before leaving it because they dared to attack Christians, and then basically leading crusade against other Christians, the Albigensian Crusade, that raged across the south of France and was mostly paid for by loans by the Cathorians, who we mentioned earlier on. That Simon de Montfort had a glorious career until one day, at a siege in the south of France, a heretic siege engine, some kind of trebuchet, flung a huge rock into the besieging army. And said rock had landed on Simon de Montfort Sr.'s head, pulverizing his skull in a messy display of gore and viscera. Grim. Anyway, Simon's son, also unimaginatively called Simon de Montfort, but now designated the sixth Earl of Leicester, had come to London in around 1230 or so, when he was about 22. By 1238, he was about 30, 2 years older than the king. De Montfort was an impressive character when you first met him. He was a highly charismatic, high-born Frenchman. He was intelligent, he was good at politics, he was very well read, and was a brilliant military leader. And he knew everyone, it seemed. He was also on the far right of the political spectrum of fanatic Catholics. No, seriously, de Montfort was all up in his Catholic devotion. He would wear hair shirts to inflict pain upon him for his sins. He would barely break his fast, being incredibly frugal with food and drink. And he often spent entire nights in religious devotions. Now, over the last 8 years in England, Simon de Montfort had become one of the king's close friends and advisors. He looked up to him. And now, suddenly, he seemed to be getting his leg over with the king's baby sister. Talk about awkward. I mean, the young woman was more than willing to face the wrath of the church over giving up her oath of eternal chastity. This was a bit of a big thing. In fact, it became a political crisis. The king approved the marriage, but he'd submitted to the nobles of England before choosing to marry his own bride, and had done the same before marrying his sister off to the Holy Roman Emperor. But here he seemed to be allowing de Montfort marry his sister without even a nod to the nobles. Maybe he was doing it to save face, and we don't know. But the barons of England were furious. Their issue is that this was a huge thing domestically. Princess Helena was the most eligible woman in England, and this changed the balance of power in the land. Simon de Montfort was to gain vast amounts of lands and income from this marriage, and more than that, it seemed to have upset the people who were involved in the previous marriage. So Henry's brother, Richard, Earl of Cornwall, seems to have gotten furious because that's my baby sister. And Gilbert Marshall, the third son of William Marshall and the former brother-in-law of Eleanor, seems to have got mad because she married my brother and swore she'd be a widow, and now look what she's doing. And this led to an armed rebellion led by these two that took months to calm down. But luckily for everyone, after all this furious armour, the situation did seem to calm down. De Montfort did seem to reconcile with everyone, and after getting permission from the Pope to marry the princess, in November 1238, the now Eleanor de Montfort gave birth to the couple's first child up at Kenilworth Castle. And then it all went wrong, just as quickly as it had gone right. See, Simon de Montfort had to pay to secure some of his new titles, which left him quite broke. So he needed money, and he ended up borrowing about £2,000 from the newly arrived in England relative of the new queen, a man called Thomas of Savoy. There was nothing wrong with doing that. But when he took out the loan, he gave King Henry's name to be guarantor for it without asking the king if he could do so. So now it was Henry's turn to blow a gasket. And maybe there was some underlying simmering anger because that whole, "That's my baby sister, you're sleeping with him." Henry III exploded in a bilious fury that his father, uncle and grandfather would have been proud of. And he accused Simon de Montfort of having seduced his sister before their marriage. And, you know, that could well be true. But the de Montforts decided that it could be best to get the hell out of England. And Simon de Montfort had an excuse to get the hell out of England. And it was a good excuse. See, a few years earlier, quote, "On a warrant from the Pope, a solemn preaching was made, both in England and France, by the Brethren Order of Preachers and other famous clerks, theologians and religious men, granting to those who would assume the cross a full remission of their sins, of which they truly repented and made confession. These preachers wandered around the cities, castles and villages, promising to those who assumed the cross much relief in temporal matters, namely, that interest should not be accumulated against them with the Jews, and the protection of His Holiness the Pope for all their incomes and property given in pledge, and thus incited an immense number of people to make a vow of pilgrimage," unquote. Yep, someone preached a crusade in England, and Simon de Montfort decided he was more than happy to jump on board. And he ended up being joined on this crusade by the king's brother, the Earl of Cornwall, who, you know, his father John had taken the cross but had never gone, but his uncle was Richard the Lionheart, so he was down for it. And the story of that crusade I'll cover in a future chapter, because the crusades and London's relation to them, they were not over, far from it. But just about then, the king and London, however, had another matter to attend to, and another celebration. In mid-June 1239, the then just turned 16-year-old Queen Eleanor gave birth to the royal heir. Now, this was not at their first attempt at trying to have a child. Rather stomach-churningly, Henry III had seemingly started consummating his marriage since the day of their wedding, and it was reported, for example, in 1237 that a man wielding a knife had broken into the king's chambers only to find them empty because the king was at that moment in bed with his then 15-year-old queen. But the news that the queen had given Henry III a male heir was greeted with wild abandon and joy. Throughout the Palace of Westminster, the clerks of the Royal Chapel sang, "Christ conquers, Christ reigns, Christ rules." And when news reached London, there was a city-wide street festival where, again, London turned away from work and danced and drank and indulged in a good old-fashioned royal celebration. Of course, there are two moments in this great celebrational royal event that gives us insights into the mind of the King of England. The first, it is said that the birth of the first Plantagenet heir for over three decades was so important an event that supposedly when gifts of congratulations from all the great nobles and bishops in England arrived with the king, Henry inspected the presents carefully and returned the ones he considered a bit cheap, sending a note back to the sender with a demand for something a bit more special. But the second thing that gives us an insight into the mind of the king at this time is what he called the boy. Plantagenet princes bore names like William, Henry, John, Richard, or even Geoffrey. These were good Norman names. But Henry III had something far more exotic in mind. He decided that his son would be named Edward, after his beloved Edward the Confessor. It was a honestly weird choice. No one called their son Edward. It was an old-fashioned and somewhat anarchic name. It carried ghosts of the old Anglo-Saxon times, now long dead. And yet, there he was, the new heir of England, Lord Edward, as he would be called. And he would be one of the most formidable and terrible kings London would ever see. Longshanks, Edward the First. But we are a while away from his story. And so, at the sights and sounds of London celebrating another royal event with raucous street parties, we'll bring the curtain down on 1239. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope you're appreciating and enjoying the series as we go along so far. Thank you to all those people who've given us donations to keep us going for another month. It is genuinely appreciated. And I'll be back next week for another chapter in the story of London. This is Saul saying bye.